overall, the trip was successful. Not monetarily.
Yeah, that happens.
Not monetarily.
Yeah.
My first tour, right, we went away. Went away for 6 weeks. I came home with $750.
Yeah.
So I covered my phone bill and my car insurance, and I was really grateful that I was still living with my mom.
Yeah.
And then from there, then it was like, can you get more time off? And I'm like, what happened? Like, you're figuring that we would just do that tour and that would be it. That would be the end of it. You know, yeah. Everybody go back to work, go back to your day jobs, you know, whatever. Maybe play Lemoore in a month or so or whatever. And it was like a Nine Inch Nails called.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Nine Inch Nails, they're about to go on tour. It's a short run. It's only like a dozen shows on the West Coast, starting in Seattle, working your way down the West Coast. The support band that was supposed to do it broke up like 4 days before the tour started. Wow. So they asked, we got the call asking if we'd be interested in doing it. And we jumped in a minivan and drove cross country to the Moore Theater in Seattle.
Wow.
And we did those shows and got literally no reaction.
Hmm.
Nothing.
Huh. Really?
Yeah. Like they weren't, all they were interested in seeing was Nine Inch Nails. They didn't care who else was on stage, you know, right, who right, else right. was on before that. So
play to a room full of people going like this.
Nothing. literally no response.
That hurts, man.
It was my job to settle the merch every night, which was very easy because if we didn't sell one shirt, we sold none. So it was really easy to settle up at the end of the night. And I remember Peter saying one night, there was he was like, somebody threw something on stage, and like, if you're gonna throw something, throw money.
Yeah.
and it started raining change onto
the stage. My god.
Oh god.
So anyway, we thought that trip was a terrible disaster. And we go home, I go back to work, and I get a call from my manager again. He's like, can you get more time off work?
For what?
And I'm like, what happened now? He's like, what? Motley Crue just offered us the tour.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this was when John Corabi was singing in the band. Vince Neil had left the band. John Corabi was in the band. Yeah. And they did that. They did the self-titled record.
I saw that tour.
So we were like, at the time, wow. I was like, it's like, why would we go on tour with Motley Crue? It's like, we're just going to get hit with garbage and vegetables. I said, I like Motley Crue. And King's X was on the bill also. So I was like, I love King's X. I was like, I like Motley Crue. I was like, it's going to be nice for me. I said, I think it's a terrible idea to have Type O Negative on the same stage. And our manager was like, trust me, this will be a good thing for you. And so I got the time off work. And that was happening in the summer. There was still this window in between, you know, when Nine Inch Nails ended and Motley Crue was starting. And our manager put us back on the road. Now we were playing clubs, and we went back to all those cities that we played with Nine Inch Nails.
Hmm.
And every room was packed.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. And so they, like, you know, like the those fans, they weren't interested in us at that moment. They just wanted to see Nine Inch Nails, but I guess they remembered us. And we went back, and then they came back, you know, and now they became Type O Negative fans. And it was a relatively successful trip. So we wound up working the clubs until the Motley Crue tour started. And then we stayed out with Motley Crue that whole summer. And that's when people started taking notice of Type O Negative. That's when we started getting a little bit more, we were starting to get some airplay, and MTV was now starting to, you know, push us a little bit and stuff. We got on Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah. Oh, what did Beavis and Butthead say? Were you cool?
yes, we were cool. He compared us. I mean, they were making fun of Peter's baritone voice, which I thought was really funny. And they were headbanging. They were headbanging real slow, and they go, "Oh,
yeah."
And they said something. He was like, "You know, this is kind of a cross between Megadeth and my butt." and Beavis was like, "That's not very nice, butthead." And he goes, "No, my butt's cool." And I was in a bar in Hollywood when I saw it, when they aired it for the first time, and I was like saying, it's like, you know, it'd be really funny if they made fun of us. I was like, you know, there's a lot to make fun of. Uh-huh. And as no sooner than it came out of my lips, I saw our video on your show, like they were like, goofing on Black Number One, and I was like, oh shit.
That's hilarious.
And then when I saw that they liked it at that time, Beavis and Butthead were like the de facto music critics of,
yes,
you know, right, the hard rock and heavy metal. They like, right, made or break people.
Yeah, well, like Warren. I think they wrecked Warren's career.
They wrecked Winger.
Winger.
They killed Winger.
Winger.
I remember this guy standing on the edge of Wuss Cliff. His teeth are whiter than white. I'll never forget that. I was like, oh my God, they just destroyed them.
Yes. Yeah.
So Johnny, I don't know if you, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I had seen that now they embraced us. And I was like, oh shit. And I was like, put your helmet on. I was like, putting my helmet on. I was like, it's like this ride's gonna get a little bumpy.
There you go. Yeah.
And then from there, then it started picking up. And then we just continued to stay on the road. And then we, like, you know, we went out when we were going to Europe, back and forth, you know, bouncing back and forth between Europe and the States, getting better gigs everywhere. And then we were getting also, like, you know, bigger support acts. We went out with Danzig, and then we went out with Pantera. We stayed out with Pantera we toured with them for like 3 months. Oh. And at that point, you know, like for Pantera, Pantera was the peak of their success with Far Beyond Driven. And we were, you know, it was like the peak of our success too. Like, you know, at that point, we were selling a lot of records every week. And that was like the best tour I've ever been on in my life. I'm impressed that I can even remember part of it.
Hmm.
But my liver still like winces in pain when I mention Pantera. But it truly was a rolling insane asylum, but it was great. And then we wound up, like, you know, developing, you know, lifelong friendships with them and stuff. And it was a lot of fun, and it was great for Typo. And and then we weren't even done yet. We did that tour, and then after that, we stayed on our own. And then we went out and we finished touring for Bloody Kisses. We went out the following summer. This is now a year later. The following summer with Queensryche.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was that with the original lineup?
Yes, it was the last tour with Chris DeGarmo. That was the last tour.
So that would have been what? What was that record?
95, Promised Land.
Promised Land. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And so we did that. And then I think we may have gone to Europe one more time. And then by the end of the year, then we were finally finished on that record. And then we started working on October Rust. Like, once we got home, I think we literally like took a few days off and started with rehearsals. We were only home for 6 months. We wrote October Rust was written and recorded within 6 months, and we were back on the road with opening up for Ozzy.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Great.
And then, is that where you, obviously you made the connection when you got into Danzig? And I don't mean to bypass that record, right, but we're getting close to the end of the show, and I know you were in Danzig too. How long were you in Danzig? Is that how you ended up making that connection to get that gig?
I think the connection was there with that because, you know, he was obviously familiar with the band and familiar with, I guess, like, you know, like what I look like, and, you know, got an idea of how I played and stuff. But really it worked out. Crew guys that worked for Typo were now working for Danzig.
Oh,
and
okay.
I had seen a post on, like, you know, like one of the metal news wires that Joey C. had left Danzig to join Queens of the Stone Age. And I saw that they had some European tour dates coming up, and they were coming up rather soon. So I just reached out. I wasn't doing anything. Typo was on a break, and I was home. I was literally home with my daughter. Had like was not even 2 years old, so I was just home. You know, we were working on music and you know whatever, and just home being dad. And I saw these dates, so I reached out to them to see if they needed somebody to fill in. You know, it was a short trip. It was only a couple of weeks. I was like, it'd be cool. You know, I probably could do, you know, like I thought I could fit the bill well, you know, with the way that I play. I thought I could do a good job with it. And wound up going out to LA, doing an audition. This was in 2003.
Okay.
I go out, do an audition. And then they had decided that they wanted to deal. They chose another guy because he was local, and he didn't have any other commitments. Where I had my priority was typo negative, and so they went with him, and it didn't work out. They called me up like a couple of weeks later, and then I wound up going to Europe with Glenn on that trip. And then when I came back, did a couple of the shows, got another drummer for himself. And they worked on they did some shows, worked on a record. Then after the record was done, he called me up and was like, hey, do you want to come out on tour? You know, he's got tour dates coming up. And I was, typo was on a break. I was like, yeah, sure. That was 20 years ago.
Wow. Johnny. So
I was in Danzig. I don't want to even say like that I'm not in Danzig now, because like, if I'm still on very good terms with Glenn and the band and stuff. And it's just like, if the schedules work out, I would definitely do it in a minute.
There was a club out here when I first moved to California called Jezebel's. And it was, it was like the Orange County version of where the Sunset Strip, you know, you had the Whiskey, the Roxy and Gazzari's, right. And Jezebel's was like Orange County's Gazzari's, and Danzig played there all the time. Yeah, I used to see him in the club all the time. Yeah, so that was a cool band. Yep. That was a fun band.
Glenn moved out to California like in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s. He left New York, and he's been out there since. So, you know, to see for him to play, you know, locally or something. He'd always do stuff like that, like, you know, play like the smaller clubs. He'd play, you know, like the Whiskey and the Roxy. And you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I even saw him play. I was in town. I went to go see him play at the Key Club. Which was
another Key Club, yeah.
Johnny, so can you tell us a little bit about your approach to the slow groove to typo? Like, how do you ever keep those tempos without rushing?
I double time the time in my head.
Double in your head.
Yeah.
So something in my body's always moving in double time. Like the heel of my foot, like I'll pivot the heel and the ball of my foot on the hi-hat.
Yeah.
Yep. So something's always there. So there'll be, you know, you'll be playing at like 60 beats per minute. I have to have something in there, you know, to keep the time going.
Right, right. So and, the song might be 60, but you're feeling 120.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. So that's when I record also, the click's always in double time. So there's always something there. There's always something there for me to grab onto. Mm-hmm. Instead of just guessing, you know, like a one,
right?
Two,
right.
And that was something like even things like where I wouldn't be leading in a song. I wouldn't be leading. Like if it was something that Peter would do, I would watch Peter's foot. I wouldn't be listening to. I wouldn't be listening to his bass. I'd watch his foot. Because he would be doing the same thing, kind of like a horse, you know, like Mr. Egg.
Yeah.
And that's how we would always, and that's how we would all key on each other.
Yeah.
Like that.
Wow.
So there was always something moving in double time.
There it is. Well, we lost a great one when Pete Steele passed. His voice, I mean, that had to be really, really hard for you. So
his voice, it was his character.
Yeah.
And his character. I mean, it was, to me, he was just a normal guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just your typical guy from Brooklyn with, you know, sarcasm and, you know, one-liners and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And the way that, you know, the way that Peter's presence was portrayed in his music. A lot of it, it really was different and contrasting. But really the thing, not so much his voice as it was his bass playing.
Yeah,
his bass playing was more unique than his voice. And I've had the honor of playing with such great bass players for so many years outside of, you know, Type O. I've been able to jam and, like, you know, play with some amazing bass players and, you know, like guys iconic, even, you know, like I play with Rudy Sarver every weekend. And there was nobody that played a bass the way Peter did.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's truly a unique experience to work with and to, like, you know, it makes me just, it made me see, like, you know, like songwriting completely, you know, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just like, you know, just holding down the bottom end. I mean, even his bass tone, it was almost like a baritone guitar.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a baritone guitar that was also that doubled as a keyboard. And then it would also be like, you know, holding down the low end on the bass as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a musical instrument. It wasn't percussive like a bass is usually percussion. You know, like Peter really approached it in such a unique way. There was like this perfect blend of like Paul McCartney, John Entwistle, like John Paul Jones, Geezer Butler, and like, you know, like you know, take like a like an, you know, throw like Elton John in there.
And it wasn't just by, it wasn't just in the studio too. My wife and I saw you guys in Anaheim in I think it was 2009, somewhere in there. And it was done live too, if you could feel
it. That's just the way that he approached the instrument.
Yeah.
And it really was something unique. It's so unto itself. I've seen people like Type O fans on like YouTube and stuff, like, you know, like doing play along videos.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. There are people that can, you know, like do something similar, but to have the vision and the creativity to come up with the things that he did and approach the instrument that way, I've yet to encounter another person like that.
Yeah. John, and you can't really, you know, you can't ever replace a guy like that, but
no.
Fans would love to see the music back, though. They would love to see it, but how do you do that, right?
You could do it as a cover band, like,
right? Yeah,
you know, the recipe is out there.
Yeah,
you know, but it's you know, it's the same thing. It's like my, you know, my grandmother's meatballs.
Yeah, right.
You can imitate him, but there's only one.
Right. Yeah. And the only person that got close was my mother. But and we all agreed, the family all agreed that, you know, while my mother's meatballs were amazing,
yeah,
grandma's were a little bit more over the top.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, you know, the same thing with, like, you know, like Peter's bass playing. It really, like I said, you know, it was, you know, it's one thing to, like, you know, whatever, cover a song or something. And it's, you know, it's all there. All you got to do is just, like, you know, put the puzzle together and you can figure it out.
Right.
But to when you're on the other side of it, when you're creating something, and then you have, like, you know, like where you have these, you know, like this vision in your head of, you know, of music where it's like, you know, like I was explaining this to my wife not that long ago. She was like, you know, because like the way, you know, the way a casual listener will listen to music and the way a musician will listen to a song. I was like, I said, I see music. I don't hear it.
Yeah,
I see it. Yeah. So like when I'm hearing a song, I'm figuring out what the drummer's playing, and I'm visualizing it in my head about how they're going about playing it. Same thing, you know, like with any of the instruments in the song. And you know, there's only a few bands where I will just listen to it for the sake of listening to it. That's the Beatles, and like the Rolling Stones. I usually don't listen to the song where I'm breaking it down and, like, you know, like, what's he doing here? What's, you know, what's this person, you know, what's that guitar like or whatever. But just listening to the song and just absorbing it and enjoying the music as a work. And there's only a couple of bands that I would do that with. And absolutely, you know, but any other thing, it's like you're dissecting it, you're breaking it down, you're visualizing, you know, like what they're playing. It doesn't matter, you know, what band it is or whatever. It's like I'm automatically, I gravitate, actually listening to music, I gravitate towards bass players, the bass lines and everything.
Right.
And like a huge fan of Motown.
Yeah.
There you go.
And Jameson, the best.
Yeah. And I try to take that approach, the way that drums were applied in Motown. And I try to apply that in what I'm doing, like, you know, in hard rock and metal and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and, yeah. And I think it brings a very simplistic, you know, like more groove focused thing where it's a foundation of something and then all the other layers can build upon that. Where I'm always trying to leave space for other instruments. Mm-hmm. Instead of trying to, like, you know, take up all that space and say, hey, look at me, look at me, look at me. Right. It's right. Like, mm-hmm. I try to present it with, look at all this.
Right.
Yeah.
You know.
Part of the team.
And I had to learn how to do that by playing in typo negative because there were so many layers in the music and stuff. And there was so many things going on all at the same time. If you had somebody that was really overplaying in the sense of, you know, like really doing too much, it would take away from the overall picture.
Hmm. Actually, you might have already answered my question I was about to ask, and you can just say I already answered it. But I was going to ask you, as an experienced veteran drummer who's had all kinds of success, what do you know now that you wish you had known when you were 22? What would you tell your younger self?
Oh man, I don't know. I was like, you know, it was always, you know, like I've always approached this as every day was going to be the last day. That it was like the wheels are falling off the bus constantly, and. You know, it's like, do I have a career tomorrow? Mm. I've been doing that for 30 years where I wake up in the morning and go, is this has to be the day that it all ends. But I've always kept a kid like mentality towards it where I've always tried to enjoy it as if it is the last show. That's the last gig, you know, like that's it. It's going to, you know, come tomorrow. It's all over and get a job, start a new career doing something else. And I've tried to enjoy it in that sense. And I've always tried to be a student of what I'm doing too. You know, I've always wanted to be the weakest person in the room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always tried so that I could learn to be a better player, to be a better musician. And I think that's also helped me be a better person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's good advice. I like that last part. You know, it made me a better musician, but it made me a better person. I think
right because you have to, like, you know, like it's a very, like, you know, being in a band, you know, is a very social construct.
We talked about that at Basic.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about important.
Hang. Yeah, it's important to learn how to be able to play well with others.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
it really is an environment that's mostly filled with people that did not get along well with others.
Yeah, right.
You know, well, like most of the, you know, 9 out of 10 times, you know, everybody in the band, they were last to get picked for the team in school, and like, you know, they couldn't get the girl, and they, you know, right. like they. You know, they were like these outcasts, these loners, and now you put them in a room with a bunch of people, and then they figure out that they're good at something, and then it creates this whole other host of challenges.
Challenges, right? Well, and, Johnny, you've played well today with others, I have to say.
Thank you so much.
So it's always been like that, like, you know, to try to being in a band. Like, you know, there's only 1 hour where being in a band where you have to be good at your instrument. It's the other 23 hours out of the day that really matter, that really determine whether you're going to stay in that band or not.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great,
completely,
great
man. Point. Yeah. That's awesome.
And that's
last,
and that,
that's, last that's, question
to me has like been the very important thing to learn.
Oh, yeah. Great answer. Thank you for that.
Last question. And it's going to be different than the normal last question. Why is Evel Knievel behind you? Chip and I have to know the answer to that if you want to know the truth. We're both Evel Knievel fans. Why Evel right. Knievel?
Okay, Evel Knievel gave me a lot of bumps and scars when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And without a doubt, I destroyed a number of bicycles trying to emulate him. he was a mainstay in my daily life in the 70s as a child. And really, I forget what happened. I wound up buying like a, I found like an Evel Knievel shirt on Amazon, and I was like, oh, I'm definitely getting that. And then I was like, I found some pictures of Evel Knievel like online. I was like, and I had this like saved on my desktop, and I was like, that'll make a good background in my StreamYard.
Yeah.
I love it.
Johnny, move to the side so we can see him one more time. Look at him.
There he is. There he is.
Oh, look at that. Oh, yeah.
Right on, man.
Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for coming on the show, Johnny. It's great time, man. Great time. Thank you so much
for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Pleasure.
It's a blast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Really nice to meet you all. Thank you again, Chip. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Johnny. Appreciate it, man.
Great to see you again. All right, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks all right, we'll see you soon, Johnny.
All right, thanks, Johnny. We'll take it out with some Motown instead of some punk.
There you go.
Go for it.